Kia ora and welcome to episode 36 of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam and in this episode I speak with Nick Ascroft. Nick. Yes, Nick is an amazing poet. There's absolutely no denying it. I think that just goes to show. And he has a new book coming out on October 13, Back with the Human Condition, which is published by Victoria University Press. So that's something blimmin' exciting to look forward to. But also, and however, what 2016 is kind of proving is that Nick can also tell you how to win at five-a-side football. Nah, bet you didn't know that. He's just had a book published, which is just, it's a great book. It's written really beautifully, like it's obviously. And also it's got some great illustrations, very clear stuff. I have never played five-a-side football, but I'm starting to know how to beat you, so watch out. The other thing, and the reason that Nick and I got together, is that a project that Nick's been working on for a very long time is about to come to fruition. Throwback is a series of books which sort of celebrates the playlist that Nick has been making sort of at the end of each year and sort of in retrospect for some years that have gone about what he considers to be the best music of that year. So the first throwback book is going to be dealing with the music of 2007, and Nick has very kindly put together a playlist for us, and well, for anyone, I guess, you can listen to. It is on our show page. So in the show notes for this episode, which will be on betterrednz.wordpress.com, so that's betterrednz.wordpress.com, you'll find a link to the playlist. You will also find links to music videos, including Malcolm Middleton's We're All Gonna Die, one of the high points of 2007 for me. So yeah, one of the most important things you can do is head over to there. When I was listening back to the interview today, I found that you can actually play the playlist in the background and listen to the interview as well, if you're fancy. But yeah, so get there, get the links, have a listen. I also wanted to just say that this episode includes music by Brent McIntyre. Brent is very kind and lets us use his electronic music on this podcast. But recently he's been writing and recording some amazing guitar music, which you can find at SoundCloud. So I've put a link there as well. So yes, I hope you enjoy the podcast. I had a great time talking to Nick. And yeah, thanks heaps. So, Nick Ascroft, how are you?
Very well, hello. Oh,
that's very good. Thank you for letting us come to your house. It's very nice. So, today we are going to be talking about a playlist that you put together for us.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if maybe you could talk about the title of the playlist and maybe just a little bit about how it came about.
Sure, absolutely. So, like all music nerds, I like at the end of every year to make a playlist of what I thought were the best songs of the year, and I have all these rules about it that I will refrain from boring you with. But I started doing it kind of when I was born, probably, but you know, you hit the 80s and you push record on the radio and you put little playlists together. But by 1995, I was seriously putting this is the best of the year. At the end of 1995, I made a tape, you know, and I kept doing that every year. And I got to the stage where I'd really look forward to the end of the year so I could make my list and just nerd out and research and make it. And especially, you know, with Napster coming about, you could just steal all the music you wanted, and it was wonderful. You didn't have to buy it. So I kept doing that, and then eventually, I had this brainwave because I just felt so depressed having finished my list, and I think it was the list for 2007, shall we say, for convenience, and I suddenly realised I'm not restricted to this year. I can do other years. I can go back in time and do the same thing and have the same joy. And so I immediately made a list for 1994, which is the year before my 1995 one. But by that stage, I'd hit upon the perfect number, which was 31. I decided they kept growing my lists, and you know, it was what could fit on a tape, and then it was what would fit on a CD, and then a playlist, you know, it can be as long as your arm. So I thought, so they kind of kept getting a little longer and a little longer, and then I got to 31 and I just, you know, slammed the hammer down, and that was all it would ever be. And so, and it seemed a bit perfect as well. It always seemed like every year there were 31 songs that I would think were not just good, and not just, yeah, I like that, but loved it and could listen to it over and over, and there would be no number of listens where I would get sick of it. That's kind of my criteria, is that, yeah, there's some songs that you'll always like or feel fond about, and I had to be harsh about it as well. So anyway, that was the 31. I went back into 1994, 31 best songs, and have darted around. 1974 is the furthest I've gone back, and it's kind of become my life work. I realised that this is what I love most to do, so I decided to make it into a series of books, and publishing books on specific years in music, and I'll be concentrating for my little piece in each one on the songs I think are the best songs. But I've got other writers writing about the year from a different angle as well, and I'm trying to get people from all over the world. So 2007 was a year I had already researched, but I hadn't done 31 songs, and I'd also discovered that it was interesting to go back and reassess and kind of relive a year, because when you're in it, there'll be songs you love at the time, but then, you know, you kind of go a bit dry on them, or the band that you thought were just the greatest, and they go on to release something really terrible, and somehow you can't look at their old stuff in the same way. And you, with some you can. For instance, I think we've got Glass Vegas on this list, and the song "Daddy's Gone" is, and I think everything they did after that first album is just poor. It's hard to listen to. There's just something great about them at that stage. And for a while, you know, I had even written off this stuff, but enough time had gone by, and I looked back at it, I was like, no, it's good. It's really good. I love it. And
Because that's, I mean, I must admit that really interests me, because I'm always interested in, kind of obsessed possibly, in that idea of the contemporary and like producing something with no hindsight. And I guess that is the thing of the yearly list, isn't it? That if you're doing it in the year that it's happening, like I sort of look back at cassettes that I made, and you know, it's kind of awful, you know, like I didn't pick the stuff that had any kind of long standing. So when did you this playlist, when did you finalize the shape of it? Was it sort of soon after, so it was sort of around this year, or
Was it the start of this year. I got the last bits of it in, and so I'd had a list of I think 27 songs from you know, that I made in early 2008, about 2007, and a few had to go, or were, I still like them, because I don't like to look back on, you know, I don't want to be too snobby about it and think, well, you know, this band isn't cool anymore, or nobody says they like Suede, for instance. And,
I say I like Suede.
Yeah, well, I do. I liked them then, and you know, the songs I like now, I still like. So I don't want to be cool about it. I want to be honest, and I want to, which is difficult as well. I think you also want to be, you want to pick songs that other people will pat you on the back for picking, but you don't want to admit that to yourself either, you know. And so it's this weird fight with your own need to be a social animal and to be a solipsist listening to your iPod. So
yeah, because music's interesting like that, isn't it? Like I have felt terrified ever since we decided to do this, because I think talking about music makes me really, really nervous. I think largely maybe because I used to hang around with musicians when I was younger, but I always feel like it's interesting, isn't it? Like I think, I don't know if it's because we're trying to talk about one art form using mechanics that isn't the art form, kind of. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I always find music nervous to talk about. But yeah, especially writing about music, like writing about music must be the hardest thing in the world.
I think you find you've got a lot to say, and often for me it's just about appreciation and why I like it. I don't try and describe the guitar sound or try and describe the feeling you get when you listen to the song, or that's not what I want to do personally, because I think that that will always be a poor substitute for just listening to the fucking song. So, yeah, and I think also there is a lot of, you know, whatever cool is, whatever sort of ridiculous haircut, you know, is involved to being cool, it is deeply tied up with music and popular music. And I think that's, in a way, it's good to sort of eschew that and just, you know, admit that, you know, I like that Kenny Loggins song and you know, and Phil Collins was rocking it with Billy Joel on that particular evening.
Yeah.
And you know, enjoy the things you enjoy, because that's ultimately what matters more, is just is the joy of it. So, and it's not about seeming like you like the most interesting experimental band, which bore you sick, or that acting like, you know, techno isn't depressing. And
I think I've spent whole years of my life doing that, actually. Oh, I'm so shallow. So tell me, so the first one of these books is going to be about 2007, isn't it?
That's right. So the series is called Throwback. So it'll be Throwback, the best music of 2007 will be the first one. The idea is that I'll hot on the heels of this, I'll have a book on 1997, one
nice.
on 1987, one on 1977, one on 1967, and then one on 2017. So there'll be all of the sevens out first. That's the goal at the moment. We'll see how achievable that is.
What is it about 2007 which made it seem right to be the first one?
I think because I had previously actually recently worked out my lists for 1977 and 1987 and 1997, and those 3 years were really amazingly interesting, pivotal years in music with some great stuff and the stories behind it. I don't know, I'd really enjoyed those years, and I thought, well, 2017's coming up, and I've still got to look at 1967, and that really excites me. I mean, what a year is 1967,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, and so 2007 just sat there like this little stepping stone that someone had to stand on, and what's great about it is that any year within 15 years, I figured out, of the year you're in, is not very cool. It's like there's a little kind of radius stick that only goes backwards, not forwards, of course. And in all of those years, you know, in these songs that we'll be talking about, it's not from a period which has yet been reclaimed, and it will be, and people will come back and copy it, I'm sure. But at the moment, you know, saying, oh, I like that particular Travis song, or yeah, or Bright Eyes, or the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, or the Shins, you know, it's this, they're liked, but it's not, you know, some of it's a bit frowned on, I think, and that's the fun part of it as well, because then it's easier to break through your kind of cool taboos if it's all dirty.
Yeah, I totally, and there is that strange cringe thing, isn't there, like sort of thinking about, you know, like, it is, oh God, you've just explained it so well. It's so wicked. So is there anything, like, I was trying to make gross generalisations.
What
laughing
did you,
about
what did
that
you
before.
Come up with that?
Well, what I came up with was ring-a-ding-ding. Like, there seems to be a guitar sound, which sounds almost, oh man, I'm so embarrassed saying this. But I was just thinking, like, I really loved the Las Vegas song on here. Like, I really, really loved it, and it seemed like it was almost like a pop rock. It seemed to be talking back to something like that. So that, I noticed that, and things did seem happy. You know, there was something upbeat about a lot of the songs, which I sort of found, which made me feel really happy, and it reminded me of 2007. Like, I think that year I was, the one album I was listening to heaps was the Bright Eyes album, but also the Arctic Monkeys. Like, I think I saw the Arctic Monkeys in 2007, and, like, that's one of my favourite songs, Fluorescent Adolescent. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I just love that song. So that was sort of where I got to. I was thinking, I looked back. It made me feel good about that year, a lot of it. But things did seem, I was really happy with those very open-stringed guitars. There's something about the guitars. I don't know. Tell me.
No, I mean, I think with that Glass Vegas one, what they were talking about at the time when it came out was that it was Phil Spector's Wall of Sound that he was harking back to, and the girl groups of the 60s, and where you're sort of where it's all just becoming a big echoey sound, the guitar, and you're not hearing when the individual strums are; it's just swelling, and they do that to great effect in that. Daddy's Gone. I think the upbeat thing, if I may jump in.
Yes, please.
I think a bit of that, because I, you know, forced this playlist on you, ends up being my own, my own taste in curating it. Possibly in that I love, you know, depressing, slow songs as much as anybody, but often I find myself as I do these lists that I'm, when I'm putting those places in and when they're getting on there, there's a lot bit of upbeat there, and I mean it's. Yeah, hopefully it walks that line of just not being complete saccharine sugar pop that doesn't have a lasting something else to it, some body to it. But I do like, when I look at this, that's terrible. Happy, ironic music. Right?
Well, this is the thing that I thought, this is the other thing which I fucking loved about it. And I think it's epitomised by the Phoenix Foundation song that's on there. Which, is it called Bright Grey?
Mm.
Yeah, like, and that's because I love those guys so much. And I just, like, Give Up On Your Dreams was one of my favourite songs of last year. And I just, I love the way, I've always been interested, like, the first pop music that I listened to was probably embarrassingly kind of Style Council, that kind of thing where it was sort of socialism and pop, you know. And I really like how a lot of these can take this upbeat kind of feeling, thinking about Brighter Beat now, but you know, can get this upbeat kind of feeling, but then can just slam you in the lyrics, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Can you do that with poetry?
Yeah, that's difficult, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think in performance of it, possibly you can, because you'll set it up a certain way and then, have a string of, awfulness, and it can become funny, and possibly you can set it up anyway on the page, but it is nice that that music has those levels that just a written art form can't really have, other than the colour of the paper,
maybe we could go for that, because that's what I really love about that Arctic Monkeys song, is that it's so fucking horrible. Like, when you, like, I love that, sorry, I'm going to get my notes, love that first line: used to get it in your fishnets, now you only get it in your nightdress. Like, it's just, it's one of my favourite songs. And, like, when you, like, it's that thing where you're kind of dancing around to it and then realising the absolute pathos of the lyrics.
Oh, Flo, where did it go?
Oh.
I love that she's called Flo as well. Like, it's like Andy Capp's wife is what I always think of in her nightdress as well. Somehow that...
Oh, my God, it's so good.
She's just such a brilliant lyricist as well. It's like, hilarious, great sort of, you know, internal rhyming stuff going on always as well, and... But so sort of whip smart, and
because that's what I was thinking as well, is that I do think there is a sense of humour possibly in British music that often isn't in some of the American stuff that I listen to. Like I'm always lost in this kind of area, like, because I'm a silly white middle class woman, but I really love hip hop, so I'm always sort of using that as a sort of benchmark around, that's what I thought was so interesting about listening to this British music, is that there is kind of this real sense of humour in there, which I really, really like. Yeah, I just think it's amazing. Sure. What stands out for you? Like, I guess you've chosen them all, and you've chosen them on your, you've kind of chosen them on your criteria. Can you remember the last song that got in?
Yeah, and it was The Thrills.
Yeah.
So the Irish band The Thrills, with the song Nothing Changes Round Here.
I love that song.
And it's one of those ones where I remember at the time I really liked it. I liked it, but I had something against it, and I can't even remember what it was. And then it grew on me, and then I had a period where there's a little arrogant moment in the song, which I don't think's bad, but sometimes it puts me off. where he's, I can't remember what he says, something like, and I took what every boy in town wanted or something. And there's something about the lyric that, that kind of turns me off and turns me on. And I, and but he's got that, that cool voice, and I'm always trying to squeak in other countries rather than Britain, America, and New Zealand. That one got in last, and interesting. I was saying that they're from Ireland, and most people are from the UK. Interestingly, in this one, because I mean I've called the playlist Indie Landfill, which was a term that became a meme to talk about indie music and way to disparage indie music, which needed a bit of disparaging, I think, if everyone will admit it that so and especially the British bands got it. I don't think America gave two shits about anyone saying the phrase indie landfill, but they don't have indie music there, and it's an odd category anyway. But what had happened was that a band like Coldplay had a big hit with Fix You, and then that band Snow Patrol was Chasing Cars. If I lay here, if I just lay here, and my God, and it was on the background of Grey's Anatomy and One Tree Hill and ads, and it was just I used to claw my eyes out just thinking about it. It still upsets me, I'm sure there will come a time in 20 years where I'll be going like, you know what, Snow Patrol nailed it on that song, but I'm not there yet. I'm not ready for that. And so there was, and I looked on their Wikipedia page, and Snow Patrol are listed as alternative rock, and that's, that's just, it's not, what's alternative about it? I mean, that's just, alternative doesn't really mean anything anyway, really, does it? But they are just a band who use a black and white image on their cover and a funky typeface, and have guitars in their videos, but it's just a blub fest of false emotion, as far as I can tell. There's something about it that is appalling, but a lot of bands were like, holy shit, this indie thing gives us some cred. And so we will do chart pop dressed up as indie. And so there was a band called Scouting for Girls and a band called the Pigeon Detectives. One of them did that song, She's So Lovely, She's So Lovely, and in their videos they were basically boy bands, but they held guitars in their videos, and so someone called them Indie Landfill. And that was fair. That was like a blow that had to be made. But I think the term was seized upon, and there was a sense that hold on, someone had pulled off the emperor's new clothes and said, "You don't have any cred to start with. There's always been shit indie and fake shambling nonsense. And why should we listen to the Wombats or the Kinks or?" Not the Kinks, what do I mean? The Kooks, sorry. And then it started to spread. It was like, Indie Landfill like Franz Ferdinand, and Indie Landfill like the Arctic Monkeys. And, it sort of encapsulated guitar bands, and you were a bit, you suddenly had more cred if you were a synth pop alternative band. And so there was a move, especially the next year, I think, following 2007, where a lot of these bands suddenly lost a lot of their audience, and the labels were like, oh, here's a, they saw a sea change, and people got cut off, and there was a moment of panic and destruction, which is always good for music, I think, anyway, to give people a fright. So I liked this idea of indie landfill, and kind of reclaiming what was good in the kind of music that I do like,
I was thinking about that. There was a really weird time, I always think about that idea of alternative, and when I was growing up, it was all sort of around the alternative radio stations, like the university radio stations. And I remember that switch happening where on the alternative radio stations it was all guitars, and on the commercial radio stations it was all synthesizers and electronic music. And then this shift happened, and I think it was around the early 2000s, where suddenly
you know, like the guitars were all on the commercial, you know, like it had become very commercial there. Like it was like, you know, there'd been some weird leap from, you know, very consumer, shiny to more rattly guitars and stuff. Yeah. And it does feel like that happened around that point. Because what, I mean, so to kind of celebrate that time just seems like a really good idea. Like, I mean, because those are the times that are of interest, aren't they? Like, I mean, those revolutionary moments in music are one thing. But, like, to sort of document kind of, like, the growing commercialization of a music type is really interesting as well, eh?
Mm. Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that was, I mean, it was the after effect of Britpop, probably.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
That there'd been all these, you know, mopey, jangly bands in Britain that the hipsters listened to. But then suddenly, you know, there was the Blur, Oasis war for number one, and everybody loved Pulp, and so yeah, you know, where there's a vacuum and there's a sack of a wheelbarrow full of cash, then you know, everybody's in there, and so there was a flourishing, and of course that means there's going to be like in anything, there's some cream, and then there's everything underneath.
Can you talk a little bit, sorry to stick particular people out, but can you talk about where Baby Shambles fits in all this? Because
sure.
I feel I misunderstand Baby Shambles and was astounded at how much I enjoyed the song that you've got on here.
The delivery. Hmm.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So can you explain a little bit about where that fits?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So I think it was 2004 or 5 when the band The Libertines sort of became big-ish in Britain, mainly, really only. And I remember, you know, getting off Napster, probably not Napster by then, would have died, but their song, what was it called, Such a Wastrel or something like that, first single, I can't remember the name, but and it started off, you know, he's a wastrel, he's a fucking wastrel, whatever. And it was like, oh, you know, you're a bit rowdy, aren't you? but it was, there was something different about it. And I liked that. I like any band that sings in the accent they talk in.
Yeah,
you know, don't,
yeah.
Don't fake that. So anyway, they were. You know, just another a band that got a bit of attention and were a bit messy on stage. And then Pete Doherty became a celebrity junkie.
Mm.
Not as in he was a junkie of celebrities. He was a junkie who was a celebrity.
Yeah.
And then we went out with Kate Moss, and so he was just tabloid fodder, and everything he said or did was immediately recorded. And it was a weird situation because he was in a band that, you know, they'd been popular-ish, and they'd been championed by the NME, but the NME champions another band. Well, they used to until they've turned into smash hits recently. But they used to champion another band every week, and so you know I'm not sure really how much they were selling. Maybe it was huge, but it was more that he was going out with Kate Moss and he was a junkie and going to prison. That was the thing, and the band breaking up, and their last song was I Can't Stand You Now. When they broke up the first time, it was a great duet about how you're such a pain, and that's and I love you, but I can't be in this band with you. Which was quite cool actually. So anyway, Baby Shambles was Pete Doherty going it alone with his own band, and I was looking around. Nobody seemed to be saying, "Hey, this is really any good," or it was because he was a bit frowned upon, not for being a junkie, but for being too popular in the press, I think, it was just, you know, if you hear too much of someone, you respect them less, probably with anyone, you know, I've spoken so much, no one will respect me right now, but Pete Doherty was actually a bloody good songwriter, and I think, you know, he's a smart guy, and he it's got something really interesting. And in fact, the other libertines were maybe dragging him down. And he got a lot better, I think, when he was in Baby Shambles. I think his solo stuff is better than anything he did with the libertines. And that when Carl Barrett, the other guy, went off and did his stuff, it was like, well, it's all right, you know, but not that good, in my humble opinion. So yeah, but this song, it was released as a free vinyl 7-inch with a awesome. With a magazine. The song comes as a delivery straight through the heart of my misery. It's just beautiful, catchy, and original, and yeah.
Because that was the thing I was finding really interesting as I was reading through as well, is because some time has shifted, the image has sort of flown off a lot of these people. You know, like I sort of found myself looking up music videos to see, you know, like who these people were. And that does seem to be tied up a little bit in this, you know, like I, you know, along with the holding guitars and music videos, I imagine there were a lot of sort of shaving of the sides of the heads and stuff like that going on. And I mean, that's a really interesting thing as well, because I remember that whole Pete Doherty kind of look, and then you know, like, and it is kind of interesting to revisit the music to, and again, what I think is so great about you doing this year is that, you know, 2007 is close enough that the image, I was just, you know, like, we've only just started to, you know, the Kurt Cobain movies have kind of only just started, you know, and it feels like this is still, because the image isn't in our mind. It was really interesting looking at the videos. I think that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a little bit out of time. It's a little too soon. It's like, I remember that. But, you know, it doesn't quite have that sheen of the past the way looking at some, shoegaze videos you know, brilliant 90s pop rap or something, you know, that's just like, wow, that's right, those videos, my God, what are they doing? Speaking of videos,
yes.
to segue into the New Zealand songs.
Yes, I was just about to ask about those.
Which I think it wasn't a great year for New Zealand, and I think part of that was that, I mean, and this is one of my stupidest opinions, I'll disclaim before I say it, but there was a time where there was all the New Zealand On Air money going into the videos, and there seemed to be a real fight to get that money, and to get that money you had to be a bit more radio friendly. And the thing is that people, I think, misconstrue about what's radio friendly is they think it's something that they personally don't like. And so people were making music that they didn't love.
Yeah.
And it was just some really stinky New Zealand music, and I'd listen through these long lists of the stuff that, because I was in Britain by this stage, and I was, you know, desperate to keep up with New Zealand music. I love New Zealand music, and I would be, you know, listening through these discs of New Zealand On Air music, and, you know, checking all the blogs and trying to find what I could, and it was painful. It really was painful, as opposed to, for instance, last year or this year, where I just feel like there's so much interesting, innovative, cool music, and I almost feel like a national government creates a bleak enough environment that people have no hopes or dreams, and so just do the music they want. I don't know. It's good that they gave money to make music, and what's hilarious, going back to music videos and New Zealand music, is there's the band The Sneaks on here. Who sort of had this one album in 2007, which I ordered and got shipped to me in Britain, and I remember holding it aloft in my office to Ben Woolhead, who also writes for this book rather brilliantly that we'll talk about later. But I got into The Sneaks because I saw this video by the New Zealand Music On Air thing, and the video is hilarious. I don't know if you've seen it. Did you watch
it? No, I haven't seen it yet.
You've got to watch this video. So it's called I'm Lame by The Sneaks, and it's just one of the greatest videos ever. Not to go too big on this, but what happens is that they start by saying, in New Zealand, New Zealand On Air gives you $5,000 to make a music video, and it's, you know, written in Vivid on a piece of paper that's being filmed, and then you kind of get this handheld footage of them being given this big cardboard check for $5,000, and then it goes, the band of sneaks decided to bet it all on a horse. And so it follows you, you know, so it's just all handheld video, and they go to the race, they go to the TAB, and you know, they and you see the ticket, they hold it up to the camera to show that they bought this $5,000 ticket where they put it all on one horse, and then they've got this big... They've got this big check, which is the joke thing that they're trying to pass through the little slot at the TAB. But, you know, they do buy the ticket. I want to believe they buy the ticket because it looks very convincing. And then they're watching the horse race and they're just having a laugh and the music, the song's going in the background. And then you see the horse doing well. And then there's this, like, surge. And, you know, they're doing all the good crowd shots of people. And then they're like, and then they've got the footage of the TAB and they, like, circle the horse going across the line first. And they win, and it's like you see them just going crazy, and then it says, and this is what they did with the money, and then the last 30 seconds of the video is incredibly expensive.
Awesome.
And there's just this constant fireworks going in the background. They're all wearing like giant banana costumes, or and they're just, and they're just, they're having a blast, and it seems like, and it's almost like a sad tale 10 years later that they've done nothing else. And I feel like that moment where in the story of the video, whether it be true or not, I hope it's true, I don't know, but that was their moment, and they loved it, and they had a lot of fun with it, and that's why the song's good as well, because it just, it's kind of, you know, it wouldn't work on the radio, this song. It's a little obnoxious and nerdy. They have a real nerd perspective. And they've just done... I think they've had another single on Bandcamp, mm-hmm. like one song. They've had some other things that are impossible to find, but... and they're apparently still going in Auckland, but they haven't played since 2011 or something. So, you know, it's you know, they've got jobs somewhere, and like most bands in New Zealand.
Because that was what was kind of interesting as well, looking at the other end of that, is we've got a Verlaine song on here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, wow. How do you keep making music in New Zealand?
I know, and it's one of the happiest stories of New Zealand music that Graham Downs and his Verlaines, whoever they happen to be, keep going and keep doing it. I mean, it's great that he, you know, works as a professor of music at University of Otago, so he's got a job and no one's going to kick him out of it. He's good at it, but he keeps being able to make Verlaines albums.
Yeah.
And he's never bad.
He's
always good. No. And and I love that about some of the lists. I think we've got Dinosaur Jr. on here as well, who had a comeback that year. I mean, and they released, you know, another song another 6 years later, and then this year they've released other great songs. And so that's a band from the 80s, like the Verlaines. And most bands have a little moment and then they peter out a bit, and you'll still admire them and like them, and occasionally they'll be okay. But some people just have the talent, and it stays there. And I think the Verlaines are like that.
Mm.
The song Midlife Crisis, you know, I think it's a good song, and it's sung by someone who's in midlife as well, which I like, and it's very sort of honest look at a midlife crisis, and that depressing kind of Verlaines way. And so not some new upstarts from Auckland, but
yeah.
Old school from Dunedin, and somewhere in the middle you've got the Phoenix Foundation, who sort of had their years of, you know, from the earlier 2000s of being sort of the cool new thing in New Zealand music, and really the welcome thing as well, because I think there was a bit of a time where there were good New Zealand bands, but there had been this surge of great ones, like from the 80s and maybe 90s that... And then it seemed like, and what else have we got? We've squeezed the tube. You know, there's no toothpaste left. And the Phoenix Foundation were sort of instantly good, but I think they've only gotten better. They're one of those bands that, they had a great sound to start with and a few good songs. But I think, you know, that their stuff's brilliant. And that the album, Bright Grays Off, is just, you know, it's end-to-end gold.
Yeah. Because that was one of the things that I always... just to talk about Phoenix Foundation and that album from... I'm thinking it was last year, but maybe it was the year before. But, like, it feels like that grind of carrying on working. And I often think of Kate Kitchen as well in this way, is that often that kind of keeping working makes the music better as well. Am I? I think I'm just saying this because writing's hard. I think I'm just saying this because, you know, I haven't been given my $1 million check yet for my book, you know. But there is something, you know, like you realise that if Phoenix Foundation had made it, you know, like they did make it huge, but if they'd made it massive and comfortable kind of huge, then maybe we wouldn't have got the album like we got last year. I don't know. Do you think that's true or am I just wishful thinking because I'm a sad ass?
I think that it's totally true, but there's so many different stories, and we try and kind of squash all of these thousands of millions of acts into the same little narratives, and that you know, act starts out interesting, gets better, or act starts with a flash and pans out, you know, fades out. Or one of the narratives I quite like is act has amazing first song and then never really outdoes it. I think that can be because some bands, you know, they're good from the start, but they haven't delivered this one song that kind of you're like, wah. And I feel like
there's someone on here
that's like that. Can you think of one like that?
I get obsessed with that movie Go about Jonestown Olympics and those other dudes who now I don't even care about, because I think they had like this huge massive thing. But yeah, I don't know, I was thinking that myself, like that is one of my favourite narratives as well. Like I just love, you know, I love that idea. I don't know,
I think there's a few like you expected that to be the truth for Arctic Monkeys, and it really wasn't.
Because that second album. Oh my god! And I was even wondering about. I was wondering about Clap Your Hands Say Yeah, because that first album just filled me with great delight, and I loved it.
Yeah.
But then it's interesting because you've got one on here, and I like it, but it's not. You know what I mean? It does feel second album-ish. I don't know.
For sure. No, and I think you're right in it. They've had good songs since, but I mean it's often a different thing because that, I mean, I think we were talking about it earlier that your first album you've got your whole life to make, right? And so it's got all of you're in it, and you don't know the business of it all. You're just putting out these songs you like, and you'll make something full of, if you're young anyway, like youthful energy in it, and the people who get that right. That's something you can't replicate, because the next one will be like, well, that was my whole life and now I'm here. But I really like that Satan Said Dance song by Clap Your Hands Say Yeah, which is different from the other ones. It's a slow drone, and it's you know, talking about being in, and it's like you're at a, it's almost like you're at a party, and I still don't quite get it, and it's like, you know, That hell is no whips, no chains, just dancing. Like this hellish being dancing, and it builds up to this bit where he's going, Satan, and he's repeating Satan, and then he goes, says dance, and then there's a pause, and he goes, so disco, and cuts in. it's that moment, it's that one moment in the song that somehow makes sense of the whole thing.
Some
songs can get away with that, like others, like, well, you're just dragging on too long now. But I'm fond of that one.
I really like it. Can we talk a little bit about, now you sent me an amazing chapter from the book that I'd really like to talk about.
Absolutely.
Can you put that in context a little bit, that chapter? Can you pray see it?
Absolutely. So Ben Woolhead is one of the four authors of this first book, and I've got people from all different parts of the globe. Ben's originally from the northeast of England, but lives in Abingdon near Oxford, I believe. I could be wrong. And he writes for, he's got his own blog, but he also writes for other music people, and he's got a podcast as well, which I should name check, but the name has now immediately escaped me. But anyway, he has written about Christmas songs. Because one of the stories of the year, 2007, is the song We're All Gonna Die. I mean, and it's a great story about how suddenly a song got championed to be the Christmas number one, to be the antithesis of these pop idol, X Factor generated Christmas number ones that were just, I don't know, they were soulless and terrible in my opinion, but obviously people love them, and again, maybe in 15 years' time I'll come back and be like, hold on, X Factor nailed it. But not yet. So Ben's chapter first starts off discussing Christmas songs at all, and it's got a great attitude in that first section, doesn't it?
So good. I love that story about the Cliff Richard song,
Mistletoe and Wine,
and how it was written. He kind of engineered it to make it more Christmassy. Like, it was just such a great, and it's just so cloring. Like, it's funny, Ben's tone's funny, but it's also really informative. Like, I love the setup for the Christmas songs, yeah. Oh, Christmas songs, what a nightmare.
Yeah, it's like good journalism, this piece. I mean, it's the best thing about the book, if I'm honest. I mean, I think, and that's why I sent it to you, because I think this, I mean, this is, you know, why you should buy Throwback 2007. Yeah, Mistletoe and Wine, just terrible song. Originally from the 70s, it turns out. And Cliff just sort of jizzed some Christmas into it. It was... Oh, I don't know. I find it...
Makes me feel filthy.
One of the worst.
I don't know if it's because of the recent turn of events with Mr. Richard, but it just makes me feel filthy, that song. I don't know what it's about. Like, even when you mention the name...
Wash it up.
I know. It's just like... And the video... Ay, ay, ay. But then Malcolm Middleton comes along with just, like, one of my favourite albums of all fucking time. I just love Arab Strap so much. And then I love what Aidan Moffat's up to. I love what Malcolm Middleton's up to. And, like, comes up with this incredible song which just makes you fucking cry. Like, it's just the most beautiful, hopeful, awful, everything song. And then someone has the idea of, let's try and make it the Christmas number one.
Yeah.
It's just such a great story.
Yeah, it is. And that was the story as, you know, you and I knew it.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
That you know, tried but didn't quite make it, and some X Factor song got it. Mm-hmm. But Ben sort of drills down into the you know, what happened and how Malcolm Middleton felt about it all, and how it kind of got away from him a bit and frightened him and kind of gave him a brush of what celebrity and you know, winning might look like, winning at life might look like. And he was...
And it wasn't great.
And it wasn't good.
Damn it!
And you could... And the parallel story of the person, whoever it was, I'm not even going to say their name, got the number one. Their story of then being like a one-hit wonder... Mm. Flop and depressed and used by the music business, and the words they were saying were very similar to what Malcolm had said about the feeling of it. And I like that little tale at the end of the piece that way.
And that almost, and that, I mean, I think this is because I'm a loser, but I mean, just that idea that losing can actually propel you into a long, do you know what I mean? Like, it was almost, because there's a great bit in there where he talks about the subsequent projects that Malcolm Middleton has kind of been part of, or, you know, sort of, he's produced a couple of albums under a different name and stuff, and you just realise that actually, you know, like, in the hands of someone who is compelled to create, you know, any situation is another way to create, kind of, you know, and like, I don't know, it's just such a great chapter. So what can you give us a little bit of a clue what the other chapters in the book are about?
Sure, absolutely. So Siri Johansson she's from Gothenburg in Sweden, but she lived in the UK for a while and various places, and now lives in Los Angeles. Is written about Swedish music in 2007. So that's really good, because I want to be true to what I like and not try and sum up the year in a way that is like, well, I've got to cover all types of music. Have I got enough country and western in there?
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to think like that. I think it's more important to, for right or wrong, I you know, to say what you like and be honest about that. And so I was trying to get, you know, a range of people, and especially from different places, to put their views in. Yes, it's sort of a very white people indie focused book. So that Sarah on Swedish music, really good stuff. And then we've got Doug Cowie, who's an American guy who lives in London, and he's written solely about one album in very really beautiful prose, and
awesome.
It's like a work of art. His chapter. I won't say any more about that.
No,
one. Leave it
great.
As a teaser. So yeah, it's four pieces for this one. The idea is I'll be doing these books for the rest of my life.
Mm,
that's what I want to do. And so I'm sure the roster of people will grow. And I mean it's difficult because I know that there's a lot of, because I'm in New Zealand now. There's a lot of interesting New Zealanders who have a lot to say about music, and I could just recruit a whole lot of New Zealanders and make it a very New Zealand-y focused project. But I like the idea of keeping it quite international, and so hopefully I can grow it in both directions as it goes. Did I just say grow it? I did. Anyway.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I am really interested in this idea of, like, music seems cultural, but I was just thinking. Sorry, I know this is the most boring question in the world, but I was just thinking, like, this wonderful thing that's happened where, and I remember it started happening probably in the 2000s, where because people were writing about certain music and you could write away and get a CD, and all of a sudden I could refine my taste to such a perfect, do you know what I mean? Like, I could just refine them so perfectly, and there was so much available. I was thinking especially about that Steve Albini keynote, which was so positive, but lots of people hated. But, you know, just that idea that if you take a year like 2007, like, were people in Idaho listening to the Klaxons, or were people in London listening to the Shins? Do you know, like, talking, you know, you seem to have a group of people that are quite different. Do you think there is much crossover? And I think, is that what's interesting about being in New Zealand, is that we kind of get bombarded with music from all over? Or what do you think?
I mean, part of it's just it's great being in the internet age. Is that it's all there. And I mean, Bandcamp is so cool, how you can go, like, well, I'm just going to look at bands from Dublin today, and you know, you can do that. Or and Spotify is my life. I absolutely love it. I'm there all the time. So, yeah, anywhere in the world, if you're in Iran or, well, not North Korea, no, I'm picking the wrong places. So there are places in the world, the internet's there, you've got it all if you can dig and can use the languages. And so that was wonderful for me, being in Britain so long and being so connected to New Zealand music, that I felt I was as much on the scene as people who were here. And I wasn't going to the gigs, but I, you know, I don't anyway, so there we go.
What do you reckon, this is a complete segue, but what do you reckon is the connection between poetry and lyrics? Like some of the lyrics that we've said, you know, like a friend of mine that writes music, she said that lyrics need to be slightly shallower because they need to hit you in a hurry and you don't get time to reread them. But there was something that hit me a lot about a lot of these songs, is they're often trying to squash a lot of words into, you know what I mean? Like, there's often a lot of thoughts and a lot of concepts and a lot of ideas being squashed into little bits. Do you think, what am I trying to say? What do you think, like, do you have a lyric part of your head which sings along, and then that's different from the part of your head that will write poetry? Or do you think that they sort of...
Well, there's obviously cross-pollination, right? It's, you know, it's a love of words and a good phrase and a good idea, and, you know, and you can have, and you can read often lyrics, and they will be beautiful. Quite often, though, you know, when you see it all written down, all of a sudden the bit of the magic's gone, and the spells aren't done. And, you know, yeah, that was a really good line in the middle, but what's going on in the second verse where you're trying to just repeat something that you... And so recently Faber put out Jarvis Cocker's lyrics, and I got to edit the Billy Bragg lyrics.
Awesome.
Lyrics, but not edit it, sorry, proofread it. Someone else did that, editing. And it's interesting, because I think... Jarvis's as well. I felt a little bit of the spell was gone just to read them written down, because he's, you know, he's got away with words and he's got something. But I think if, you know, him or Billy Bragg were to be only writing poetry, they'd be a little tighter.
Yeah.
You know, you can go off where you will with a song, and then you've always got the chorus to come back to, and so it's looser in a way, but ultimately has more power. And I will listen to a song hundreds of times. I'll read a poem 5 times. You know, so it's so I think lyrics win.
Yeah.
in the great war of art that no one's fighting.
And there's also, I was just thinking, like, I was thinking this ever since we decided we were going to do this. Yeah. Why are you not a musician? Yeah. Like, why poetry rather than music? Like, I mean, because there's that weird, there's that thing that I always miss, the same friend of mine who writes. I remember sitting with her mum once watching her play, and she was saying to me, oh, that's what you miss out on as a writer, isn't it? That collaboration, you know, because, you know, Caitlin sings jazz. So, you know, there was all this amazing, just incredible stuff going on. But, yeah, why poetry instead of a band?
Yeah, well, I was in a band with the terrible name Squid Christmas.
It was a good band, though.
You know, check it out on SoundCloud. Maybe don't do that. I got to the stage where with writing the lyrics, I was just writing a lot more of the lyrics than I was writing the music.
Yeah.
And when I'd have to write the lyric, it would have to fit the rhythm of the melody, and you'd have the melody, and I loved the puzzle of it, the Sudoku, cryptic crossword side of it, where okay, you've got to have the stress up there, then it's two, you know, unstressed syllables, and so I'd be, you know, be focusing on the sort of the nerd work of writing the lyrics, but it was torturous because I kind of held myself to this crazy standard for it as well, and I wanted to craft these perfect lyrics of these songs, which I then never recorded. I still write some songs and noodle away in my bedroom. I think the collaboration thing that you're talking about, I was never a good collaborator. I was a little Nazi autocrat that you know, told people what to do, and when they write their own songs, I'd kind of be like, well, yes, we could do your song, I guess. And I mean, I wasn't that much of a dick about it, I hope, but I was a bit of a dick, and I think that it became easier to not to be in a band. They're all lovely people who I still really like, but I was having more success with the poetry as well, and it was. And it seemed a friendlier scene as well. I think the music scene, people were a little bit bitter and snide when I was in amongst it anyway. And that, I think that was just an unlucky period in Dunedin bands. But all the people we came across, or maybe we were just annoying. They were bitter and snide for a reason. But so I mean, I'm really pleased with a few, you know, I've got a few songs which I look back on, and I look back at our bumbled recordings of, and I think, you know, that's all right. That's okay. I was never going to be the Arctic Monkeys, and I'm cool with that.
And did you know other poets at the time? Like, how did poetry seem like an option? Like,
yeah. Well, I guess. I'd been interested in poetry. I guess it's hard to almost cast the mind back. I remember seeing David Eagleton and Oamaru, where I was from, and seeing reading Cilla McQueen that some girlfriend had given to me, and you know, and being like, oh, this some of the stuff is really good, and then other stuff I'd be like, oh god, that's just boring and fake and awful, then I met Kapka Kasavova, who was in the linguistics, and she was publishing poetry, and I was like, well, I can do that too. And so, you know, I gave her some of my poems, and she was not cruel about them. And then there just happened to be a little bit of a poetry scene happening, and started going along and meeting the people, and it felt like we were building something in Dunedin, and we were the young Turks, but there were no old Turks, you know.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so I think it was that. It was that it was... You always feel... You're always compelled to do stuff that is working well. Whereas the music, you know, we had our Radio 1 top 11 number one hit for Squid Christmas for 5 weeks or whatever. We had our slightly sad moment in the sun, but it was never going well for us. We had 15 people at most gigs, and it was... I wrote one song about it that was... There's a band, only 15 people came to see or something. But, yeah, so whereas with poetry, you expected 15 people to turn up.
Yeah.
That's what happened with all of them. So it was... That was doing well.
Yeah.
So it was, yeah.
And I'm so... I don't know. Like, I mean, again, totally... I don't know. Like, I just feel really grateful that there's this combination of person in you, if you know what I mean. Like, there's this... Because I just... I mean... I think the idea is so great, and like to sort of have enjoyed this playlist over the last couple of weeks and that, and to think about the book coming up, it's just such a perfect combination, you know what I mean? And like that wonderful thing that if perhaps you guys had, you know, become famous, we might not have had the poetry and then we might not have had the book, which is really good. To finish...
Yeah, no, it's good.
I'm very happy.
On that front.
Oh, yes, yes, congratulations. No, I'm sorry, I'm being like Pollyanna. So... One song that we haven't mentioned to finish up with that you'd like to tell me something about, what would it be? Oh, can I just mention this band Foals?
Yeah.
Holy shit. I really enjoyed that. And that was something I was thinking about. You were talking about it before, like the strange game that they play with technology on that. You know how you were talking about like the... With Glass Vegas, there's that idea that it sounds like sort of 1950s girl band kind of stuff, and there's something about that Foals song where they try and make the digital noise machines, you know, there's a sequencer on there that they try and make sound like an old school kind of Hammond organ or something like that, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah,
anyway, sorry.
Sort of guitar thing as well, where it sounds like he's playing it like a piano, you know, saying. You know, but in this odd riff that, you know, people were calling math rock or whatever.
Yes, that was what it reminded me of, like, because I was thinking of Battles and all that, and I was thinking, oh my God, it sounds a bit like Battles. And then that crushing vocal comes in, like that absolute barking kind of vocal.
Yeah,
I just thought that was incredible. Thank you for that. Sorry, now I've gone off on my tangent. What would be something that you'd like to finish off talking about?
Yeah, well, I would be interested also in any other songs that stuck out for you. So I think Canada only get two hits there. I thought Tori Amos was from Canada, but it turns out
she's not.
And then by this stage, I think she just moved to Devon or wherever she went, to Cornwall or somewhere. But anyway, that aside, there are only two songs from Canada, and it was this was a year Arcade Fire sort of blew up a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think that had an album before that, but and I feel like that they got better, but Canada was about to become sort of a really big player, I think. And so here we've got Caribou, who I didn't discover until, I think, 2010 or 2009 or something. So, it was interesting going back to the roots of Caribou, and the song is great. She's the one, it's called.
Oh,
and,
it's so good.
And I can't get enough of it. I think it's brilliant. And then... we've got Rufus Wainwright here, who sort of half falls under Canada. I think he was actually born in the US, but then grew up in Montreal and tries to be Canadian. But here he's singing, and I think actually there's a lot of anti-war element going on in these songs. There's the sort of the war, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan is dragged on, and there's a sentiment in a few of the songs, and the Good, the Bad, and the Queen one. But with whichever one I was just talking about, Rufus Wainwright, going to a town. I'm going to a town that has already been torn down. And I'm so tired of you, America. And it's a beautiful melody, this song.
Yeah.
It's just got, and it, there's something really powerful about it, and I've never heard a Rufus Wainwright song that's as good as this one. I just think this has got a great lyric, which is really sort of heartfelt and almost sententious, but is beautiful and affecting, and it's, you know, he's telling America off. He's giving them a whack over the knuckles and saying, after dragging the body of Jesus Christ in blood, I'm so tired of you, America. And it's, I don't know, I think that was the foreshadowing of great Canadian music that was happening, but I wasn't hearing it, and was soon to really blow up, and I think people would suddenly think of Toronto as the centre, you know.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. And I was just thinking, I mean, that's what's really nice about this as well, is that the way that the... because there's a Björk song on here as well, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, that sort of comes out of nowhere. And the Bright Eyes song comes out of nowhere as well. Like, that Talladega album... is that the album it comes off? I think so, anyway.
Yeah, let's say it is, yeah.
Yeah, I just remember that being such a... I think that was the only album I listened to in 2007, which is really embarrassing. But I just, you know, like, I think that's what's really nice about this playlist as well, is that, you know, things... And that's what I think with the Rufus Wainwright song, is that it feels... is that word prescient? You know, it feels like something that is about to happen rather than something, you know, that is in that landfill, you know what I mean, which is so great.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting, because... there's also the same year, you know, the National recording songs.
Yeah.
Dirty Projectors sort of had their first songs. Vampire Weekend on here that I didn't discover till the next year. The next year, sort of Vampire Weekend and Glaze Vegas were my favourite bands. But they both had released stuff in 2007. I just hadn't, you know, encountered it. But so these bands were about to become, you know, considered the great bands of their time. By some other people, obviously loathe them, but.
Yeah. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was only going to say that that then there were the Fleet Foxes who sort of almost were the answer to the indie landfill. It was, you know what, let's go folky and it's all right to be Americana. And then suddenly, you know, there was that. I mean, a lot of those bands existed, but you know, there was this massive new thing and other countries embraced it.
That's what's going to be so great about this series is, like, because that's, I mean, I'm very annoying at home, because anytime, like, we're watching the Get Down at the moment, and I'm just sort of saying to Brent, oh, so did that come out of disco? And he's like, no, it more came out of soul and funk. And, you know, like, I'm just always interested in these waves and tides that happen. And I was just thinking, especially, I just keep going back to Las Vegas, but you know, you can imagine that in the 67 book there's going to be sort of lines to draw that way, and there's going to be, you know, like these weird, you know, like you've got the technology changing so wickedly and fast. Yeah. I just think, oh my god, it's going to be so good.
Yeah, and all those, you know, Dunedin bedroom bands in the 80s, they were just listening to stuff in the 60s. It was like the 70s never happened, you know.
Yeah.
And so the often some of the best new acts are just not listening to what's going on at the time. They don't connect to it.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting, is there's their take on something that they feel they're among, which is a whole different year. And so yeah, that is interesting. But it also, as I do this, sorry to drag things on, but that you realise a lot of the narratives aren't quite true either. That they're easy to talk about, like, and genres especially. Genres kind of don't exist, but they do exist. But genres are really just people copying other people, and some people don't copy other people, or they accidentally only copy some bits of it. And things like punk, you know, seems like a clear thing, and it's a story, and it's become a narrative. You know, music was shit, and punk came along and solved the day. And you know, that's not how it happened, but that's a good story. And it's same with the indie landfill, that you know, there wasn't any more of an indie landfill. It was just that people said there's an indie landfill, and so it was just what was talked about. But it did affect things, and so yeah, it's bizarre that the narrative itself affects the narrative.
Yeah, because I just find that so interesting as well, because I think that's that thing of trying to capture and sort of commodify one art form and another. You know what I mean? Like, I was just thinking about the Get Down and some of the dreadful TV shows and movies that have been made about music recently. You know, we do try and make a narrative around it, you know, and I'm the worst at it, you know, like, I mean, I'm just like, oh, well, punk happened here, and this is happening in America, and there you go. And I do think, and I think that's what I really love about music journalism, and I think that's what I loved about that chapter that you sent, is that it didn't try to order anything neatly. It sort of was more observational, you know what I mean? Like, it was sort of, and that thing you were saying before, like, it's not trying to recreate the music in another form, it's just talking about it, it's sort of responding to it in a different way, which I think is really good.
I'm appreciating it. Yeah, no, I mean, what I most love about Ben's piece is just his story that for many people Christmas is awful.
Yes.
And that Christmas is depressing and nasty, and yet, and so for them Christmas music is just salt in the wound, and it's all, oh, let's sing about fucking holly. And,
yeah.
And, you know, and I love Christmas, and I love Christmas songs, and I think there's a whole lot of brilliant alternative Christmas songs, and so reading that, I was almost, you know, wanting to stand up and say no, but that's what's good about it, is that, you know, you can't, I responded sort of in a gut way to that, but it's so true. People loathe Christmas, and it's horrible. They've got to have this syrup spoon fed to them every year.
Because it is, I know, as someone who don't like Christmas, I find it an extremely depressing time of year, and I feel like the songs are making me feel like a failure as well, you know what I mean? Like, every time I hear, you know, why are you not smiling? Yeah, why are you not joyous? Yeah, and it's just, that's what I so loved about the sort of like, the thought behind trying to get the Middleton song to number one.
You're gonna die.
And it's just such a, I don't know, like, I find that way more, you know, that beautiful lyric that's in there, that sort of joins us, you know, we're all going through it together, you know, like, just, and just thinking, oh yeah, I think I will be doing that this Christmas. I think what I'll do is break out Brighter Beat and read Ben's chapter and just feel okay.
It's great. He's like the prophet speaking to thousands that we didn't know existed. Yeah.
That's so good. Hey, thanks heaps, Nick.
Oh, thanks, Pip.
You're a rock star.
Ah!
See what I did there?
Not actually.
Not actually.
Failed rock star.
Failed rock star. Thank you very much.